Audi.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive, America's number one motorcycle insurer. Everything is more exhilarating when you're on your motorcycle, just like your bike is more protected when you choose Progressive Motorcycle Insurance. They offer coverage for your bike starting as low as $75 per year, and they keep things affordable with discounts like paid in full, multi-policy, and responsible driver. So raise your kickstands and get to quoting at Progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. $75 premium is for state minimum coverage. Not available in DC. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. I'm recording this in Spain after several days in Paris. Very lucky to go to Disneyland Paris with my children for the 30th anniversary, a place where I spent some time working some years ago, which was a crazy experience. I've probably told some stories about it on the podcast before, and I'm sure I'll tell some again at some point. But it was incredible to be back. Really, really good fun. And then also showing my kids around Paris, the city, for a couple of days afterwards. They'd never been. And I'm not going to say it was without its challenges, traveling with children on my own, especially to three different centres, because we stayed in Disney, Paris, the city, and then down here to Spain. All that packing and unpacking. But it was well worth it and really good. And it's just such a buzz to be travelling again. I hope you've managed to have some travels yourselves and have some interesting ones planned as well, which I hope to do very soon. Now, a quick warning to anyone listening with kids or anyone sensitive to swear words. I'm about to utter a swear word in the introduction to this episode. I'm not going to beep it out. It's the title of our guest today's own podcast. But after that intro, it's all reasonably clean. So if you're sensitive to a swear word, skip forward until after the introduction. Now, we all have career successes and failures in life, ambitions we achieve, yet also ones we're too afraid to attempt, but then might regret it, or one day we might just make that leap. My guest today, on the advice of none other than Joan Rivers, ditched her high-flying career in television at the age of 45 to start again at the very bottom of the ladder as a full-time comedian, a move that has now paid off with a lot of travelling, a lot of stand-up all over the world, and regular TV appearances. She has many an inspirational thought on grabbing life by the balls, how we navigate through both life lessons and also the world we live in. See what I did there? It's a travel metaphor. I'm sure you got it. Anyway, here we go. Here's my guest. Remember the swear word coming up too. Stand-up comedian, star of comedy TV shows, and host of the Namaste Motherfuckers podcast, Kelly Beaton, has jetted off to some of the world's most hottest parties when working as a high-flying TV exec, knocking back vodka with Madonna and Goldie, flying business class and staying in the best hotels. She promises she's actually more at home in a tent, at the zoo, a nice one of course, and getting dumped by a boyfriend, a not very nice one it seems, at the airport in Iceland. Live from her laundry cupboard in Amsterdam, it's Kelly Beaton. Why are you in a laundry cupboard in Amsterdam?
I'm in a laundry cupboard in Amsterdam because I live here part of the time. So my kids are half Dutch, but I'm not with their dad anymore. Just oversharing right at the start. So I've always had a kind of link to Amsterdam. And when Brexit happened, together with a Dutch friend who's in property, we decided we'd invest some money, not in the UK.
In a laundry cupboard.
In a laundry cupboard. So I'd actually live in that. It's not like Harry Potter. We do have a sort of rest of a flat. So yeah. so I'm over here quite a bit, but when we're doing recordings, I've discovered if I do it, it's an old converted grain warehouse, a beautiful old sort of huge building. Not that we have the whole of the grain warehouse, but unless I'm in this little cupboard, it literally sounds like I'm screaming out of an open window. So this is where I am. So it's,
I love the
very
way
low
you're
rent.
Justifying yourself. I'm not in the laundry cupboard, but I'm not in the big grain warehouse. You're somewhere between the laundry cupboard and the grain warehouse in terms of size of house.
And probably in terms of status, as that's really a good metaphor to sum up my life, to be honest. So yes, it's nice to be talking to you in my running kit in the laundry cupboard in Amsterdam. That's quite fitting for your podcast.
I'm kind of jealous of the Amsterdam thing. I used to live there. I'm, funny enough, I'm in Spain at the moment.
So why are you in Spain?
I'm with my children, who dad isn't Spanish, but I am no longer with their dad and my husband. And but my parents live here, so I grew up in Spain. Did move to Amsterdam once at the toss of a coin.
Why did you move here?
Because it was tails, and we had to. We were drinking, and we did a toss of the coin, and it
really?
Was tails. We moved the next day.
Yeah. How amazing!
Yeah.
It went badly. Oh, did it go? But where did you live? Were you in the centre?
I remember behind Leda's Plain at first. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's pretty central. Very central.
That was just for 3 nights. We only had enough for 3 nights in a hostel. But then I bumped into a Danish guy that I went to school with here. He knew some Swedish girls who were living in a flat, and they emptied one of their beds for us, jumped in a bed together, and we stayed with them for a few months.
Wow. Well, there's a story. I came quite quickly. I met my kid's dad in London, obviously pre us having kids, or it would have been a miracle. And we moved fairly swiftly within 6 months we were here, not within 6 hours. So there you go. Yeah, that's an impetuous decision on your part. I stayed 3 years. So I lived here full time for 3 years, but that was ages ago. That was, 25 years ago.
Describe to me where you are. What's it look like?
The Eastern Docklands, it's called. It's really lovely. It's a bit, so if you look at Central Station on a map and you've got all the kind of horseshoe shapes of the canals, we're along the river, about a kilometre along the river to the east of Central Station. And it's actually really beautiful. People don't, well, some people in Amsterdam know this area, but like it's a bit like the sort of Shoreditch of London. So it's at that sort of point of development. So it's so we're right on the water, but not on a canal. We're right on the river. And there are these little sort of islands with houses on. And they're really, it's really, really beautiful.
I can absolutely picture that. I thought you were there working.
I do work here as well. Yeah. So I do work here. I normally gig when I'm over here. And there's a really lovely, there's a couple of lovely comedy venues. The Comedy Cafe, where actually my daughter's just finished studying at the university here. And she used to work the bar at the Comedy Cafe. I might add, I was there first as a performer, and then she got the job at the bar. You can figure how that worked. But once she started working on the bar, now she lives in Madrid, but once she was working on the bar, she'd always be like, you can't come and perform when I'm working. I'd be like, excuse me, I think you'll find it's meant to be the other way around. So I gig a lot here. But this time, now that we're in the Zoom world, as you know, because we're recording this, I've ended up, I mean, I might as well be anywhere. I've got 3 podcasts today. So it's like, I'm going to be sitting in this cupboard for 3 hours of today, even though it's beautiful sunshine and I'm in Amsterdam. So the downside of Zoom working and the upside is that we can do all this stuff anywhere. But then instead of going somewhere abroad and thinking, oh, now I can't work, you go abroad and you're like, well, I can still just fill my diary. So, but yeah, I do, and I work, I do bits of television work over here as well. So yeah, I do, and I speak Dutch, useless skill, but I do. So yeah. I kind of, it is a home from home in a way. Yeah.
So many opportunities for heckling when your mum's on stage as the comedian and you're working behind the bar. Does that ever happen?
Yeah, it definitely does. And I used to, as comedians do, we don't always, everything we say is vested in some kind of truth. But we don't tend to, you might, if you've got a good joke about your kid being 14, you'll keep that joke going until your kid's 20, if it's a good joke. And my daughter was still being referred to as a 16-year-old. And by then she was like 20. And she was like, oh yeah, I'm still 16, am I? So now, and actually it was partly that made me start writing material. I never used to admit how old my kids were, because I don't think people realize I'm quite as old as I am always on stage. I do reveal my age at a certain point, but I was always wary at the beginning of saying my kid's real age, in case anyone was like, oh my God, you're like a mum's age, we don't want to listen to you. So it was kind of was strategic as well. But anyway, partly spurred on by my not 16-year-old daughter, I aged them up, and I now do reveal their real ages on stage.
You look incredibly young. Yeah, you do look incredibly young. So how old are you? I'm going to ask.
53. I'm 53.
Oh, so, are you? You do look very young.
Oh, thank you.
But to me, 53 isn't old now. As a 47-year-old, it doesn't. 53 is not old anyway.
We'll do a little mutual. Well, this, if I look good in a laundry cupboard, maybe I'll just put all my online dating profile pics. I'll retake them in this laundry cupboard. It's obviously working for me. Maybe it's because it's so dark, you can't actually see me.
You know, it's nice. It's bright and everything. It looks good. So tell me, how did you get in? Well, obviously, I know a little bit, but for the sake of the listener who might not know, you were working in TV before you got into stand up.
I was, yeah. When I heard about your podcast, and I love your podcast, by the way, congrats, it's fabulous. And when I heard about it, I was like, oh, this is just perfect for me to go on, because my whole life, sort of working life, adult life's revolved around travel, really. So in terms of, this is getting to your question of how I got into it. So I worked for MTV when I was sort of in my mid-20s. I was living in Amsterdam, applied for a job at MTV through the trade paper, Broadcast magazine, which I'm sure still exists, but probably is an online publication now. It's the only time I've ever applied for a job through a physical paper. And I sent off, you know, to try and get this job. And then that actually started my kind of travel journey, because I wasn't actually massively well traveled at the time. I was quite an insecure kind of young person, and I was very nervous of travel. So the fact that I was living in Amsterdam, then getting flown to London and New York for a job interview, was very counter to my life and my comfort zone. Anyway, I got that job, there's a lovely story about the impact of that first trip to New York and that job interview. There's a couple of things that came out of that trip in its own right. And I then worked for MTV on and off for the next 20 odd years. And MTV, I did do other things. I worked for ITV and other broadcasters, but I kept coming back. It was like my homeland. I loved MTV more than anything. And then MTV became part of Viacom, and Viacom also owned Comedy Central, still does. Now it's Paramount, which owns Viacom, but it still owns that stable, still has Comedy Central, Nickelodeon, other channels in it. And so I was very much connected with Comedy Central, but Comedy Central in the US. So I worked for the US head office, but based in London. And so I used to meet on-screen talent from Comedy Central. I was a sort of boring business person, so I was there to generate revenue from content. So not a sexy job, but I did get involved sometimes in the sexy sort of side of things. So we would go to like Cannes or Banff or wherever, and we would bring on-screen talent with us in order to sort of generate interest in the shows that we had. And it was the late, great Joan Rivers, who I got to know quite well. And I would sort of I'd be the sort of business executive who did a bit to the jaded drunk TV executives before whoever the turn was came on and did their thing. And I did that for Joan Rivers a couple of times. And it was Joan Rivers who said to me over dinner the last time I saw her, and this was not long before she died, she said, you know, you should do stand-up, you've got a sort of natural thing on stage. And I said, you know, I'm 45, I'm a single parent, I've got two kids, one of them's got special needs, massive day job, I can't, it's too late. And she was 81 at the time, and she just looked at me and said, I'm 81, you're going to realise that 45, you're in the heart of things. And it took, and this hopefully, there might be somebody listening who might go, oh, right, so that is young. Already at 53, I look back at 45 and think that was young. But when you're 45, you're really preoccupied with, oh God, I'm middle-aged now, it's kind of not game over, but you know. And so actually those words were really important to hear. So I would have always thought, because I went to drama school, but I never pursued it. And partly because I wasn't a very good actor, and I would never have been very good at it. But, and also I just didn't have the confidence at the time. And I think you can spend your whole life going, well, I could have done that when I was young, but I can't now. And it's been a really powerful thing for me about the fact that you just can keep reinventing with ambition. And by the way, I have my difficult days. You know, this isn't a redemptive story. It's not like, oh, it was perfect, I did my first gig and life was sorted. You know, it's a challenge like everybody's lives are. But I just, I think it's a really, with travel as well, you know, I don't want to be someone whose world gets smaller as I get older, either literally or metaphorically. I want to keep getting out there and feeling things and trying things and doing things and feeling the sun on my face in kind of different places. And I think it's a really nice thing to realize you can just keep doing that.
When Joan Rivers tells you you should try, you should be a stand-up comedian, you do it, right? I mean, if that's not a sign from anything, you know, that is a sign from anything. It reminds me, I was reading I flicked through a book in a museum. I never bought it. Sorry about that. But I flicked through this book that was something about with nonagenarians and people that had reached 100 as well, saying what they wish they'd have done. And an old lady, an 100-year-old lady, said that she'd wish she'd taken up the piano at age 50 because she could have been playing for 50 years by now.
Yeah, that's a really good... Actually, that's the same kind of story, isn't it? Because you also... We're going to be, I do lots of kind of keynote and inspirational kind of speaking. That's, you know, that pays a bit better than comedy, and it's a not dissimilar skill. But they, I always sort of say to people there, if you're thinking about reinvention, probably people are going to be working what for a careers that span 50 years or something now. No one's got safe pensions. And if you're going to do that, you might as well do things that you like. Everyone's going to have to reinvent whatever job anyone who's listening is doing. If you think you are that job, that's very risky, especially if you're on someone else's payroll. So when I was, you know, senior vice president at a massive US studio, I never felt that I had that status. So I was never traveling on my own dollar. I was never traveling in the front of planes or staying at the Four Seasons, even though I did do that for work when I was on a work trip. But I always knew, well, really, I'm not a person who's going to be sitting at the very front of planes and spending, you know, 700 quid a night in a hotel. That isn't me. So I'm not really going to ever live like that. And I'm not really going to let it blow my skirt up. I'm going to sort of live with myself and my kids as I think we can actually live on our own merits. And I was right to think that, because even though I was in and out of that company for 20 years, which is massively significant, I expect there will be at least another 20 years. You know, I gave up the day job a few years ago. There'll have been at least another 20 years of this career. So it's kind of like anyone listening who's like, oh, I'm defined by this is where I am. And this is, it never is. Whether you love it or hate it, change is usually just around the corner. And you never are going to be what it is you are that day for that long. So if you hate it, that's reassuring, because you're like, well, it's won't go on forever. And if you love it, kind of hold on to it, because the next thing will be different. So I suppose it didn't feel so weird to suddenly be much lower status, because, you know, comedians are quite low status. You know, you're like, you know, get up on stage, make me laugh. And it doesn't pay well. Being a comedian is a terribly badly paid thing to do. So I think it does. I've gone off on a ramble, but I think it is about daring to try those new things and knowing that reinvention is not only something you could embrace, but you sort of have to. It's kind of inevitable, isn't it?
I feel exactly the same. Exactly what everything you're saying, I absolutely agree with in terms of reinvention, but also in that, you know, I fly, I get upgraded sometimes, and I stay at the Four Seasons.
If you don't get upgraded, I don't know who does.
Not always, but you know, you look around, and I've stayed in hotel rooms that are like 10 grand a night.
I know, me
and
too.
I look around at breakfast and I'm thinking, who the hell pays this? Because I'm sitting here, but they're probably looking at me thinking, wow, you know, is she paying this? You know, everyone's probably looking, but there are people who are actually paying that. I'd love to be able to pay that. You know, I'm not saying I necessarily would, but it'd be quite lovely to actually have the opportunity to afford it.
See, I wouldn't know, with all the, it's weird, with all the money in the world, I don't know what it is about it. And maybe it's a fundamental feeling of not belonging or not being good enough or something. But I just never do feel at home in those kind of places. I remember one of the loneliest birthdays, in fact, the loneliest birthday I've ever had. I can't remember which birthday it was. It would have been one in my probably early 40s. And I used to travel, like when I worked for MTV, I had people who worked for me in offices all around the world. So I would travel a lot, even just to see my own kind of team, let alone see clients or other things. And so I'd go to Singapore once or twice a year, among many other sort of regular stop-offs. And I went to Singapore on my birthday, because at the time I thought my kids don't really give a shit about my birthday. I wouldn't have done it on their birthday. As it turned out, they were upset I went. It didn't occur to me they'd be upset I wasn't there on my birthday. And it was the second day I was in Singapore, and I was staying at the Four Seasons. And when they found out it was my birthday, which they obviously saw on the check-in, you know, on my passport, they upgraded me to this massive suite. So I was in this, I mean, it wasn't horrible, obviously. Sorry, Four Seasons Singapore, but it was just enormously lavish. And the bedroom happened to be also next to the lift shaft. So weirdly, in that amazing massive suite on my back, I was literally sleeping next to the lift shaft. So I couldn't even sleep. And then on the day itself, they just delivered all this incredible stuff. And like, and also the office, the MTV office delivered stuff. And I had like beautiful, huge, like an orchid and flowers and a massive cake. And And I just thought, this is, first of all, I can't take any of this with me. I'm leaving in 2 days. So that's a, it felt just like so wasteful. But also I just thought I, nothing could be lonelier, that I would sooner be at my crappy kitchen table covered in sort of egg yolk stains with a kid giving me a sort of shittily hurried together present. And it just sort of summed things up for me. I just don't. So weirdly, if I had all the money in the world, I would love to travel more and be able to, I certainly would love to travel at the front of planes. That is money very well spent.
Definitely money.
And when you've
well
done
spent.
It, you never want to go
somebody
to
somebody else's money well spent, but still. Yeah.
Exactly. So that is a luxury. If I could have, if money was no object, I would do that. But I just prefer places that are lovely, but more basic than that. I don't know what it is. So I'm not actually a big fan of a massively luxurious hotel. I don't know why, but it's just not my thing.
So there you are. Like, make me sick with jealousy, because I've done all this stuff too later on. But going back to me in my early 20s in Amsterdam and my failed attempt to travel the world, I would have killed for a job at MTV. In fact, I MTV, being an MTV presenter at that time, was my ideal job, because music and travel are both my passions. Well, actually, music was more of a passion than travel at that point, and it's remained a passion. And my trip to Amsterdam was a great failure. We managed to stay there about 9-10 months, moved to Antwerp for a little bit, never earned any money, played in bars for free beer, never managed to save, and broke up with my boyfriend, came back home with no job, and did actually get a job in music actually after then. A couple of jobs in music, but I actually accidentally fell into corporate events. And through corporate events, you know, I did get to travel. And my first trip out, you know, anywhere really exotic was Bangkok. And I was flying business class with a flat bed at like 25, 26. And that felt crazy. But my heart was crying out to work at MTV. So you stole my ideal life.
Stole
at
your
point.
Job.
How dare you? There you are in Amsterdam. You get flown to New York to get the job in MTV. Tell me about that New York trip.
Yeah, so that was, I'd only ever been to the States once before, actually quite recently before that. So I'd gone to San Francisco with my kid's dad, although, as I say, that was all prior to us having kids. So, and that was a bit of a revelation to me. It was the first time I'd been anywhere other than traveling within Europe. So I'd just not long been to San Francisco, and which I still think is one of the best cities in the world. So then to be being flown, so I was flown to London for my first interview with MTV. And back then, this is the early 90s, nearly mid 90s. As you know, we know, there were no budget airlines. So when we were living in Amsterdam, I'm always trying to explain. So living in Amsterdam, as you know, back then, or you were here slightly later than I was, but there was no one had email over here. It was just about starting to come in. Some of my friends in London had it, but we didn't really have it. You didn't have cheap flights, and you might as well have been in Alaska. So it was incredibly hard. You could sometimes find ways to cheap phone calls, but even that wasn't easy. So we couldn't afford to fly back to London apart from maybe once a year, and people we knew couldn't afford to fly here, and there were no cheap, easy fixes. So already getting flown back to London for the job interview was amazing, because I was like, oh my God, someone's paying for me to go to London and is paying for me to stay in a hotel and I can see my friends. And then the second interview was in New York, and I just couldn't believe anyone was flying me. I actually think, looking back at it, I think they did fly me economy, actually. But at the time, I wasn't like, why are you flying me in economy to business? I was like, oh my God, you're flying me to New York. They put me in a fairly shit midtown hotel, again, not a sort of fancy one that I started to have the privilege of staying in when I worked there. But I remember waking up, you know, wherever the hotel was, up sort of north of Broadway somewhere. And I ended up walking down to the office, which is on Times Square, MTV's office, having the interview in this amazing, whatever it would have been, 48th floor corner office of the then president of MTV. And again, it was much less hierarchical. There's no way a couple of years later, somebody at my level, I was going in as a manager. There's no way I'd have been interviewed by him. So I got interviewed by this godlike figure within MTV, along with a couple of other people. And then I came, and I so desperately wanted the job, as you'll relate to, Lisa. And I came out, and there were those sort of lit up billboards you have on Times Square, like the ones on Piccadilly Circus, only sort of higher. And Beavis and Butthead, there was a Beavis and Butthead billboard with a massive MTV logo, sort of whatever the, you know, that was their big sort of show at the time. And I remember standing in Times Square, looking up at Beavis and Butthead and praying to the gods of Beavis and Butthead at Times Square that I would get that job. I mean, I was desperate to get the job. I then did, I think I was literally in New York for the rest of that day. I don't even think I had a second night. And I did everything. I went to Central Park. It was Christmas. It was December, I think. I did the interview in November, but they had the ice rink. So I went ice skating and I went to like Barney's and I just like whizzed around all the kind of classic spots of New York. And I remember being on that plane on the way home and I went straight back to Amsterdam from there.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive, America's number one motorcycle insurer. Everything is more exhilarating when you're on your motorcycle, just like your bike is more protected when you choose Progressive Motorcycle Insurance. They offer coverage for your bike starting as low as $75 per year, and they keep things affordable with discounts like paid in full, multi-policy, and responsible driver. So raise your kickstands and get to quoting at Progressive.com to see if you can save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. $75 premium is for state minimum coverage. Not available in DC. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Thinking this is it, I've got to get this job, desperate to get the job. And I think it was very quick. I heard I'd got it. And my life completely changed. My first week working for MTV, I left Amsterdam about 6 weeks later. My partner couldn't leave that quickly. So he was still here for a while working. I was traveling and coming back to see him when I could. And he would come to London when he could. And literally my first week working for MTV, I was supposed to spend it in the New York office, even though I was going to be based in London. So I relocated to London, immediately packed my bags to go to New York. There was a blizzard and we got relocated and had to land in Toronto. I then spent that. We couldn't get into New York because of the blizzards. I then had this weird thing in Toronto, and I've got my mum's two brothers lived in Toronto at the time. So I had this unexpected, I'd never been to Toronto. Then I was meant to be going to Las Vegas, having spent time in New York. And because of the blizzards, I had to go straight to Las Vegas. There was no chance. So suddenly, my very first week at MTV, it was a diverted flight, an emergency landing, Toronto when I didn't think I'd be there, and then Las Vegas. And I remember thinking, right, you've got two ways you can do this. You can either be like, well, I want some control over this. I want to know where I'm going, how it's going to be. Or you're just going to have to go. The adventure is going to be the travel, because you don't know where you'll end up. And it was, sorry to keep using the word metaphor, but it was a real metaphor. It's like, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know how this is going to go. And I was such an insecure, wanting everything in my control, uncomfortable person at that age. It was an absolute revelation to me and probably set me up for life, because I think I could have been someone that was just too scared to do those things. I never did the sort of traveling as a teenager. I never did a gap year. I was just incredibly insecure and scared of life, even though no one would have known that who knew me. So yeah, it probably was all the things that you think it would. And thereafter, I mean, what an amazing job. I did get pregnant quite quickly. I'm not entirely planned. So that did slightly change my massive freedom. So I had an MTV baby quite quickly. So it was a matter of either leaving him or ideally taking him with me. So he then did come on all my travels, either with his dad or with a nanny. So I used to bring him with me everywhere as well as a little baby. So he also had quite a cool MTV life, my son.
That's
Jake.
Very interesting, because yeah. I know people that worked at MTV at the time are growing incredibly jealous. And it was a very young place. You were a young person, but it was a very young place to work. For someone to have a baby and be able to take that baby, I mean, that must have really stood out.
No one had a baby. Like, I remember they didn't have maternity leave. So the MTV London office, because MTV Europe hadn't been founded that long before, you know, the MTV US had been going over 10 years by then. But so there wasn't a proper maternity sort of deal, because no one had I don't think anyone had had a baby, because it was such a young staff. So I remember I was put under the US maternity policy, which was shit, by the way.
Yeah.
And so I had this weird kind of hybrid experience. So I had to go back to work when Jake was an absolute weeny wee thing. I mean, I remember going to the EMAs, the European Music Awards in Rotterdam, when Jake was 8 weeks old, 10 weeks old with him. I obviously didn't take him to the awards, but, you know, he was with his dad in the hotel room. And then I had to go to Las Vegas or New Orleans or somewhere quite quickly after that. So it was either take him with and be a mum or don't take him with. But I do remember going, they used to have these amazing end of year parties. But MTV used to have these amazing parties and New York staff parties. Don't know if they still do them, but they were like incredible. And I remember going to one really heavily pregnant. And I remember I'd had to get a doctor's letter to be allowed to fly to the States. So I was whatever stage, you know, matter of not many weeks to popping. And I remember the attendant, and obviously at that time I still looked good and I had a good figure even with my bump, you know, by my second one it was a whole different story. And I remember the attention I got, and I remember someone doing like a henna tattoo on my tummy, and I just got like that. I just had the coolest experience. I was like, you know, oh my god, you're having a baby. So it was like I was the first person who'd ever had a baby. But it did slightly affect, I think I probably would have lived in New York at some point and lived over there and worked from that office for a bit. And in fact, that was in the works when I got pregnant with Jake. So that was one thing I missed out on. But I used to go like every 4 to 6 weeks. So I kind of feel like it's a home from home city. So it was an amazing experience and slightly different because I'd had a baby.
Very different. I don't know if you can hear them right now, but that sort of juggling work situation. I'm in my parents' place here in Spain, and in the spare room back down the end of the corridor, I've locked my two children.
How old are your children?
They're 9 and 7. So that my mum is locked in a room with the children now.
And you've got the run of the place.
Front room. Yes, so I was like, cool. How long are you going to be? Can I use the internet? Just like, shut up and get in there.
I was recording one of my podcast episodes with Jack Stein, Rick Stein's son, who's actually really, really interesting guest for you because he has traveled the world. Yeah, he's brilliant. I can connect you. He was in Australia at the time we did it because his girlfriend and mother of his children is Australian. And I got the time, I assumed that he was in Sydney, and he wasn't. He was on the other coast, so I got the time differences completely messed up. This time it was like midnight, and I was supposed to be speaking to him at midnight. And if I'd waited till the time it was meant to be, it would have been like 4 in the morning. And he was like, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I'm awake." And this was like 7 in the morning for him, or something where he was, or 6 in the morning. And he's got tiny children, like a toddler and a baby, and literally, so he was in like his mother-in-law's an artist, so he was in this artist studio of his mother-in-law's. And he'd literally just thrown the babies in the kind of grandparents' bed because his girlfriend was still asleep. And I felt so bad the whole time. I was like, "Are you sure the kids are all right?" He's like, "It's fine." So he'd literally, that no one was awake, and he'd been like, "Here are the children." So yeah, I had that experience with him, of him being out in the outbuilding with the children stuffed into whatever corner. So I feel it's my lot in life to be doing podcasts while parents are neglecting their children.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's the way of the world. But it wasn't the way of the world when you were doing it. So you're a trailblazer. You're reminding me a bit of like, Sheryl Sandberg, is it? The CEO of Facebook. I read her book called Lean In. I think we're all leaning out a little bit more now, it feels like. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I think it was, I mean, Jake's nearly 25 now. So I guess on the plus side, what I have got is, you know, I was pretty much independent with my kids by the time I was in my mid to late 40s. So I guess what I'm doing it the opposite way around. So I'm probably having my kind of, not mad years, but I'm kind of enjoying the freedom now, although I am about to get a dog. So I seem to always stuff up my own freedom.
Yeah, they tie you down, dogs. They really do. I've seen it happen to my neighbour. They're lovely, but they do tie you down in terms of travelling.
Yeah, although I do think that as long as you've got a good sort of infrastructure of people who love your dog and have dogs, then I think probably if I'm willing to reciprocate, I think it'll be all right. And also I'm going to get him a passport. So this, you know, he'll be able to come here with me, and yeah, we'll find a way.
So the MTV years sound amazing. Who were you working with? Were you working with all sorts of superstars?
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of, I do remember that I had, my office at the MTV in MTV in Camden was next to the boys' dressing room. So everyone who had to come out, all the male kind of acts who had to come out and do any of the stuff that they were recording in the atrium, or I'm sure you've been to the building as it was back then. So I used to see literally anyone who was recording anything would literally have to walk. I had a glass office. They would literally walk past my office. So I did see a lot of kind of phenomenal kind of people. I suppose the big ones from those days, and like we're talking mid-90s by this time, the Mariah Carey story of insisting that they were Labrador puppies. And yeah, that happened. That was at MTV. So we were all, so she ended up on the sort of balcony of MTV looking out on the courtyard. And one of the demands, as well as the puppies, was that all the staff would come and be out there. So when they filmed it, it would look like she had like loads of fans. And I remember us going, there was no way I was going to stand in as a Mariah Carey fan on a, so loads of us were like, no, like we see people like Mariah Carey every day. Like, we're not going to fan it because she's, and also get some real fans. We're like by Camden Market. I'm sure you can find 200 people. So that happened there. It was that I went.
Was the puppy story true?
It's true. Yeah, it is true. So that all happened there.
I always thought that was a tabloid.
No, it's true. I don't think it was loads, but I think it possibly was one or two. But yeah, there was a Labrador puppy.
Still like demanding a puppy, you know.
Yeah, also poor little puppies. I did the Unplugs back then. And so I saw the George Michael Unplugged, and he only had 18 people there for that. And that was amazing.
Wow.
thing. And I went and I saw the, I was at the Oasis Unplugged when Liam didn't turn up and Noel did it. And then Liam started heckling from the balcony. So I think that was at the Royal Festival Hall, I think it was. So yeah, I was lucky enough that I met and saw and kind of, yeah, I was cheek by jowl with some amazing people.
I probably walked past your glass office on one of the most humiliating days of my career, in that I was, when I came back from Amsterdam and I was working in the music industry, and you know, I always wanted to be a presenter. I mean, I am now, and I have been for like 15 years now, but back then I had a massive crisis of confidence. My thyroid went haywire and I put on lots of weight and I used to get quite panicky and anxious, but I still wanted to do it. So one day I was doing recording some local stuff in Brighton in the Pavilion Gardens, and an MTV scout was there, as they used to, you know, have presenter scouts, and I was doing my own little pieces to camera and I was okay and confident there. They were like, come up for an audition. You know, when something really means a lot to you, means so much to you that you just fail completely.
Oh, I mean,
you must have so much confidence, you know, getting
up on stage.
No, I screw up
every time the stakes are high. Yeah, I always screw up.
At the time I was like doing corporate events. So I'd be hanging around with like the CEO of HSBC, which is a worldwide organization with hundreds of thousands of people working for them over 80 countries. And he was Sir John Bond. And I would have not an ounce of nerves talking to him because he meant nothing to me. You know, I never wanted to work in banking. Soon as I got to MTV and made the long walk down past your glass walled office and they put me in front of the camera, it was the same girl that I'd met in Brighton. I just suddenly I was really inside my own face. It's the only way I can describe it. I was so terrified. I could not speak. I couldn't look into the camera. I just absolutely fell apart. And she said to me, what happened? And I was like, I have no idea. But I do have an idea. I was like, I was terrified at the time.
You wanted it too much.
I wanted it too much. Yeah. And that it would have been absolutely perfect for me. And it was that later, like two or three years later, I went back and I did an MA in broadcast journalism. The very first time I was on the radio, I was like shaking like a leaf, reading every single word, doing the travel news, you know, traffic and travel news, reading every single word from a paper. And then I got exposed to that. And then you know, got to the point where I could just switch on and do it straight away. And it's just exposure and exposure and exposure. I had to just do it. And now I can do it. You know, I'm on TV all the time without thinking about it. So if MTV, you know, if they want to, you've done your stand up. If they want a 47-year-old single mother of two presenting like the new bands, although MTV is not the same station.
It's not
anymore.
Music now. They don't have that. So the job that you wanted sadly doesn't even exist, you know.
No.
So I know exactly what you mean. I remember the gym. There was a gym on that sort of open, that courtyard on the left as you go into MTV. That used to be the MTV gym. And I remember Davina McCall was always kind of working out there. She was like the kind of like poster girl of like cool MTV person. I mean, I would not have had the confidence to do it on screen. In those days, I didn't even dare do a presentation to people. I was so scared of my own voice. It took me years to become a good public speaker, let alone sort of stand up or presenting. So I couldn't have begun to do what you did, even getting as far as auditioning, to be honest.
But how can you do, how can we be, you know, we've both been those sort of shy, nervous people in those situations. How come you are doing what you're doing now?
Well, you just learn to do it, don't you? I mean, I know that when I ran a little production company that was bought by ITV. So I left MTV for a bit, worked for this production company, then ended up running it. Next thing I knew, I was on the ITV board. Quite young, you know, my early 30s at the time. And I remember them saying, you know, you need to do a presentation for your business. And they'd hired out the Odeon Marble Arch, as then was, I don't know if it's even there now, a 2000 seater. So all the staff from all the constituent parts of ITV were going to be there. Alastair Stewart was anchoring it. And everybody I had to do like a 10 or 15 minute business presentation. And thought, well, this is when I'll leave the company. Like I'll either get found out or I'll literally have to resign before I have to do it. And I just sent myself off on a public speaking course. I didn't even tell them that's what I was doing. And again, I look back now and I think if someone were to say, you know, advice for younger people, one of the things I would say is no one knows what they're doing. Everyone thinks they're going to be found out. And if you don't know, it is okay to ask. Didn't occur to me to say to anyone, I'm 31 or whatever I was, I've never done this. Please, could I have some help? Please, could I have some media training? So I just paid for it myself and took it as time off, as holiday. And then I wasn't great at it, but I was passable. No one would have been watching and going, God, you're dreadful. I definitely wouldn't also have not got feedback of like, you took the roof off. And then I just got more, I just had to do more of it. And I realized I was all right at it if I didn't have to follow a script or a PowerPoint. then obviously at some point you do have to use sides and work out how to do that. And it literally was just doing it. And I just think I matured really late in terms of knowing who I was. So I think now that I don't have high self-esteem, the opposite, but I do know that if I show that and I'm a bit more honest and authentic, people are much more willing to step in. So as a stand-up and as a kind of speaker, I'm not afraid to let people know what I find difficult. So yeah, but it just like you, I guess, you just, when you do it, I've just done it. I've done thousands and thousands of hours on stage now. And so obviously now I can do it, but it takes a lot of effort to make things look effortless. And I think we know that. Perhaps people watching us don't realize that.
And you've got to make people laugh. I mean, that's part of the job. I like to think sometimes I make people laugh, but I don't have to.
Yeah, but that's a whole lot. And again, you know, as a stand-up, you've just got that they're used to, there's a kind of, I don't know if people still say it, but there was a bit of sort of adage that it takes about 100 gigs to get to be remotely okay. And you could easily knock through those 100 gigs in your first year if you're committed to it, and lots of people are. But it takes at least 100 gigs, I would say, to get remotely good. And I look back now at some of the stuff I was doing, like even 2 years ago, I'm like, ugh, you know. So yeah, you just do it and progress. And yeah, that's what happens.
Where has your stand-up taken you? I mean, I think we've gone there in terms of metaphorically. We know where it's taken you and developing where it's taken you. And I love this conversation, actually. That's what I love about talking about people's life stories through travel, because it's not necessarily always about travel, but literally, like actually, geographically, where has it taken you?
Well, I kind of made a bit of a name for myself on the New York scene, because whenever I'd be over there for work, and at the time I was doing it on the quiet, so I was calling that's why my birth name's Caroline Beaton, and Callie was always a nickname from people who knew me well, and my family and kind of friends and boyfriends and stuff. And I went under the name Callie Beaton in the hope that no one at work would necessarily know I was doing it. And then I did some stuff for Gotham. I did a competition with Gotham Comedy in New York and did well in that competition, and that kind of helped me get gigs over there. So I did a lot of gigging in New York and in the States. And then I basically have always tried to gig wherever I am. So wherever I go, so, you know, I've been to Iceland a couple of times, the country, not the shop. And I've been to the shop as well. Where else do you buy the cakes for the cake bake sales at primary school that no one will know you bought?
I make them, obviously. I can't buy
these from Waitrose and pass them off, because all the other mums would have got them from there. So I buy them from Iceland, bash them up, put them in Tupperware. But yeah, but Iceland, the country. So I've been there a couple of times. I did an Edinburgh show about my first trip to Iceland, because it was such a sort of dramatic story. I got dumped at the airport by my boyfriend and had this weird state decided I would stay on, and it was kind of what time of year it was, but a time of year when even the Icelanders aren't traveling through Iceland, and went on this ill-advised road trip and ended up getting stuck in a blizzard, and I shouldn't go near countries with blizzards, and nearly dying. And it was a quite a dramatic story. And so I did an Edinburgh show about it called Invisible, about disappearing in the snow. And it was also the year I turned 50, so it was the idea that you're meant to disappear when you turn 50 as a woman. But getting back to your gig question, so I've gigged in Reykjavik, I've gigged in, you know, Madrid, I've gigged in Berlin, so wherever I go, I mean, we went to Borneo with the kids because my son's a zookeeper. We went tracking orangutans in Borneo. I didn't manage to gig there, but I have gigged. If there's a possibility to gig and I'm traveling, I'll gig. Yeah.
So hang on. So you're arranging your gigs around your travels, not your travels around your gigs. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So I don't... I mean, if someone said to me, and again, my dream now would be, your job would be kind of my dream now, to be honest. We've finally done the switcheroo and you've got the dream life. But yes, I think now, so I like, in terms of traveling when I first was doing stand up, you'll go anywhere for stage time. It's just so hard to get stage time and no one's booking you. You've got to just seek out the gigs. Since lockdown, I've realized that I am ambitious in comedy, and I'm doing more telly now, which is lovely, but I don't really have a desire even to be hoofing up to Manchester regularly to gig, not because there's not an incredible comedy scene. I absolutely love the venues there, and they're some of the best comedians in the world there. But I just think, you know, I can gig like largely within half an hour, an hour of my front door, and and the lovely gigs and lovely venues. So I don't particularly want comedy to define where I go, but when I go somewhere, I'll always try to fold it in. And there's always a comedy club, and you get it's a really good way of seeing another side of a country you're in, and you get to meet local comedians, so you've instantly got a little bit of a circuit of people. So yeah, I definitely do it that way around. I mean, I try now to be a bit better if I'm with my kids or something, if I'm to visit my daughter, I'll try not to waste a night gigging, because it's a bit like, Mum, you're only seeing me
there
three
she is
nights.
Again. Yeah. Exactly. Mum's getting on stage again.
Yeah, exactly. I did one gig in Singapore and that was terrifying because they're so strict on what you can and can't say. And if you said, there are certain things, same in Dubai, you know, there are certain things if you say you're in deep shit and I'm so nervous that it might slip out
in
crowd work. I'll end up in prison. So yeah, so, but I have gigged.
Good story though.
If I ever get out. So yeah, I've gigged all over the place that's sort of tied into my travel schedule. Yeah.
Your son's, okay, there's two things, so many things I want to pull out of that conversation. Your son is a zookeeper. My 9-year-old would love to be a zookeeper. That's his ambition. Well, I have to set them up for a conversation.
Yeah, you should. And actually, if it is his ambition, my son's ambition was also to be a zookeeper from when he was a toddler and playing with his toy animals. He's autistic and he always was obsessed with animals. He had this encyclopedic knowledge of animals and particularly primates, anything to do with monkeys and apes. And so we spent God knows how many hours of their childhoods we spent at zoos. Wherever we would go, he'd always want to find the zoos. And we would always do that. My poor daughter, who's got zero interest in animals, or not zero, but she's not a fanatic. I still wanted to be at 9. He still wanted to be at 13. He still wanted to be at 18. And now he is. So if your son is massively competitive, like people might not realize, it's so competitive. It's like cutthroat getting to be a zookeeper. So he's
really, interesting.
Really, really hard to get into and get established, and the good zoos and your, you know, the ethical zoos who are properly sort of working in conservation and the animals are kept incredibly well and all of that stuff and have proper breeding programs. And
where is he based now?
Paynton Zoo in
Paynton.
Devon.
Oh, amazing. Incredible. I used to live in Paynton. Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. It's one of the, I didn't realize when he got, I don't think, I must have been to Paynton Zoo as a child, but I ended up visiting him when he'd first got the job and thinking, oh, it'll be like a sort of one up on a petting zoo. And I was like, oh my God, it's incredible zoo. It's like, I don't know, six times the size of London Zoo, and just in this amazing, well, you know, this beautiful sort of quarry land. It's amazing.
I've never been there actually, because I didn't have kids at the time. The guy that I ended up living in Paynton with, the guy that I tossed the coin with, and ended up living in Amsterdam, because I think he still lives there actually. I was in Paris last week, and we had 2 days in Paris. We had Disney before that, but we had 2 days in the actual city. And on the second day, where did I end up? Paris Zoo. You know,
there you
just
go.
Because
I've been to
it's a great zoo actually. Really.
I've been to every zoo in every place. And even now I do zoo trips. There's an amazing zoo if you ever want to do one, which is nice for you and actually really interesting from a travel perspective. There's a zoo called Paradisa, which is down not far from sort of Ghent and that bit of Brussels. Mm-hmm. It's quite near the French bit of Brussels. And it's this
Belgium.
They've got Belgium. Yeah. I do know.
Yeah, now I know. Yeah.
So yeah, cut that.
I mean, considering you're in the Netherlands, right?
Exactly.
Now,
I'm quite good. I used to work in Brussels, so yeah, in Belgium
and indeed Brussels.
Yeah. So this Paradisa is this incredible. It's an incredible zoo. It's on the site of a beautiful old abbey. And they've got proper high-end accommodation by the animals. So if ever you want to do a zoo trip that your son would adore, it's not cheap. It is proper 4-5-star price of accommodation. And you can stay literally in these with glass windows and watch the walruses or the polar bears swimming, or you can stay in ones where you're looking out on the bears. So literally from your bed, you've got the, and it is the most real good sort of travel tips that anybody who's remotely, and you get access to quite a lot of the zoo at night, but only if you're staying there. And they've got like a cocktail bar next to the penguins.
Oh, now you're talking.
So yeah.
You had me at cocktail bar.
Cocktail bar by the penguins. So that is a combination of luxury travel and a zoo would be Paradisa, which is in Belgium, not Brussels. Yeah.
And but those two are, you know, in each other. Well, one is in the other.
Yeah.
And getting dumped in Iceland, but you're almost dying in a blizzard. What happened?
Yeah. That was, yeah. So he dumped me at the airport. I ended up in a little place called Helna, which is on the kind of east of Iceland on a kind of peninsula. And yeah, got stranded with a travel car, walked, sort of not knowing I was near Helna, not knowing which direction to walk. Nothing was kind of working. So yeah, that was an amazing way to see Iceland. And I ended up sort of, by the time I finally got back to Reykjavik, I mean, I was only there like less than a week, but all that happened in that time. And I actually went back to Iceland with another boyfriend about 2 years. It was totally out of the blue. He dumped me at the airport. I just to this day don't really know what happened. He was not a good bet as a boyfriend anyway.
Let's call him up and ask.
Yeah, exactly. He was I did afterwards find out that he'd got a bit of history of behaving incredibly weirdly with other girlfriends. But anyway, that's another story. But I went back to Iceland about 2 years later with another boyfriend because I thought I want to do this trip with someone and enjoying it, like in a non-life-threatening way. And he and I also got, this was not even a time of year when they normally have it. We got stuck in the weirdest blizzard and we had to divert to somewhere else, like an industrial town. So we were meant to, I think somewhere called Selfoss. We were meant to be staying somewhere like beautiful and kind of more touristy. And we just had to go to the nearest place. And it was this weird industrial town. And they did have one big hotel, I think, because people were coming through en route, wherever. And it actually ended up, we had this incredible views. We had these like windows that looked out across the mountains and the water. It was just like, it was just the weirdest, most wonderful thing, like ending up there. And sometimes the weather got enough that we could go out for like an hour from there. Not, you didn't want to go much further because the weather was awful. So yeah, Iceland and me, I think I will go again, and I need to go in the nearest they get to summer and stop getting stuck in Iceland in blizzards. But it is one of the
most... Was he not tempted to dump you at the airport just for a laugh?
We did split up, actually.
Not at the airport.
Not on the trip. We almost did split up on our last night. So... And I was like, whatever's happening, we are staying together until we get to Heathrow. You are in, committed, as am I. I am not having another breakup in Iceland. We break up about 2 weeks later on home turf.
You need to go back a third time and see what happens. I reckon you're going to meet the man of your dreams.
I'd like to meet an Icelander. An attractive folk, I think. Yeah, I love a sort of very Northern European sort of Viking, like that's my thing. Mm. So either a sort of Nordic or Icelandic, or yeah, that's my kind of guy. My daughter's always like, I should set you up with someone in Madrid. My particular thing I love is a sort of like bearded Viking-y, pale skin sort of,
yeah.
You can see my colouring. It obviously is just a kind of like where I feel comfortable. Yeah.
I think I've got one for you, actually. I'll arrange it off air.
Let me know. I'm not on any of the apps at the moment. I can't be asked, but if anyone's got a suggestion.
No, I've come up as well recently. Yeah. I've come off.
Yeah, I can't be bothered at the moment.
Yeah, no.
If we think of anyone for each other, that could be...
Definitely. Like, yeah.
I think that's what they mean when they say cross-promotion with podcasts, right?
We've crossed careers. Exactly. I've got your dream job. You have my
reverse dream job.
I might have your dream man.
I might have yours, although I need to think. But if my daughter finds an eligible Spaniard of my age, I'll be sure to pass
on. No, I haven't. I mean, I won't get into it. But no, I'm more of the line of you are as well in terms of what I go for. No, not the beard, can't do beards.
I love a beard.
Where have we I can't keep you forever. Where have we not been in terms of your travels? Do you have any burning stories you want to tell me?
So where I've not been, there's whole swathes of...
No, sorry, it's like, no, where have we not been your travel stories?
Yes. So, and
I was trying to be poetic, but failing.
Yeah. Where have we not been? So I guess one of the ones that was a real kind of eye-opener for me was we went to South Africa, and as then was Swaziland, and we did that sort of pretty much backpacking, me and the kids, when they were teenagers. We didn't go to the sort of fancy bits. And obviously we went to all the kind of anything to do with wildlife. We did end up going to Kruger. So that was an amazing trip, and sort of just, you know, being in many places without any kind of electricity and really basic sort of, you know, by then obviously phones long out of charge. And so that was quite an amazing trip. That was about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. Borneo was amazing. Went there with the kids, and again, wildlife driven. I've been traveling basically the world dependent on what wildlife there is and what my son wants to see, as opposed to what's happening with my career.
Being my future, as long as I can afford it, you know, which is I can't, but they'll find ways. I literally remortgage to take them to Disney. I feel like I'm going to be the same, like traveling.
It's an amazing thing to
traveling
do,
the world's zoos.
Yeah, and see, and also you can do the more adventurous, you know, when we were seeing stuff in, you know, on that sort of South Africa trip, you know, that there's some quite adventurous ways to see animals, and same in Borneo, you know, you're not seeing them in enclosures. It's actually a real privilege, and there's something about I do love nature, and I now know a lot about animals. I'm almost a primate expert, even though I don't have a huge amount of interest. But you do see the world through one of the most beautiful ways to see it is through the nature and the natural kind of habitats and animals. So actually, bless his heart, I've seen some quite amazing
things. He's educated, Jay.
He has, and we've gone to good places, you know, Copenhagen Zoo, and zoos everywhere, basically. Yeah. Lisa. So there's a lot. I could definitely do a whole episode on zoos around the world with you.
It's also quite brave traveling as a single mum, and I don't mean necessarily because feeling vulnerable, because I don't know, it wasn't going down that route, but I was thinking brave about the logistics of it all, because I find the being the one adult in charge of the two of them, in fact, I find this at home, on the logistics side, the domestic side, the packing, the unpacking, the paperwork, the making sure you've got everything, all of that is quite challenging. Not the enjoying of the situation with them, that is lovely to me, but maybe because those are the skills that I lack and I find challenging. Doing all that logistics stuff for three people is quite hard.
Yes, definitely. It's terrifying. I mean, we have done some adventurous holidays together. And I mean, we started doing more adventurous ones when they were kind of teenagers. And not that they could particularly help as teenagers, but I felt slightly less responsible for them than I did. Yeah, but it's really hard. And the kids say to me, they're like, oh, you're much more relaxed and you've got much more chilled out as we've got, you know, than you used to be. And it's like, the reason I'm chilled out when we're all traveling is because we're all adults. Like, what is to stress about? If I'm with 220-somethings, something goes wrong, it's not just on me. So it's kind of like, no, I didn't just suddenly get all chilled. Life has got easier because you're older. Like, so I've had it in airports all over the world, you know, where with the kids, where I'm like, I don't know what to do. When we landed in Joburg, we got stuck for like 3 hours trying to get through passport control. Then we'd arranged to get picked up by someone. They didn't turn up. We didn't, you know, it was that trip alone. There were numerous times, you know, couldn't get the tents up, then a panther got loose at one of the places we were. And it was, and I was like, oh my God, I literally am going to kill my children on this trip. Like, never mind, just not give them a great experience and just all get a tummy upset. I'm going to actually kill my
attacked by a panther.
Exactly. Because I'm just a shit mum that I didn't even do the research about where we could pitch our tent. So yeah, I hear you. It's quite a pressure. And you know, and traveling on my own now, you know, most places I go alone. Obviously I know people in some of the places, but now that feels like such a minor challenge compared to doing it with dependent humans. Yeah.
There was a time in Paris last week where I was choking back the tears on the way to the airport, sitting on the floor of the metro because there weren't any seats. The kids were sitting on the floor and it was just packed. And I was holding everyone's backpack by that point with the straps digging into me and, you know, like trying to make sure we changed in the right place. And I'm almost choking back the tears, you know, but it is absolutely, it's worth
it. I've had exactly that experience. And actually also going to Disneyland Paris. So, or actually I think it's coming back. We were trying to get wherever we were trying to get next, but yeah, it is. I've definitely had those moments and where you just end up finally getting to bed and everyone's safe and you literally like overwhelmed. I've cried in many hotel rooms and under canvas in many locations with just relief, shock and exhaustion. Yeah. So that's the other side.
Oh, so I'm going to ask you my last question now. My last question is always about music, because to me, you know, music, the whole reason I'm doing this podcast is because they won't let me present Desert Island Discs. So there's another job failure. Yes.
Because that one easily do at this life phase.
I feel like I could do that now. I'm well practiced and well versed enough. So I failed at MTV. I haven't yet failed at Desert Island Discs. It's kind of like Desert Island Discs for travel a little bit. But I do believe that music and travel always go very much hand in hand as well. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel. What is that song and what's the
Broader than a song, and I ended up last night sort of thinking about what would be the sort of it was the MTV Awards in
you're just rubbing it in again.
I know, I'm sorry.
I wasn't at the MTV Awards.
And so that was my first VMA. So they have the EMAs in Europe, and then they have the VMAs, the Video Music Awards in New York. So, and the reason I looked it up was for the date, and I've now managed to save it without the date showing. So I think it's in a September. So it would have been September 1997. No, 1996. So I'd been in the job at MTV for like less than a year. And it was at Radio City Music Hall. It was partly being there, like, oh my God, this is my life now. I'm somebody who can go to things like this. I remember what I was wearing. I remember how I was feeling. I hadn't had the baby yet. I don't think if I was pregnant, I was newly pregnant. My partner was over there. We'd flown him out as well. And it was the Fugees did a compilation. So that was in Killing Me Softly, I guess, would be of the compilation that was in it. So I guess the Fugees Killing Me Softly and watching them do that on stage at the Radio City Music Hall at the MTV Awards in 96. That would be it.
Such a buzz. That must have been just such a buzz.
Amazing. Yeah, it's such a buzz. And then we end up, this is going to really annoy you even more because you didn't get I was staying at the Royalton Hotel. I don't know if it was that one or the next year, but at one of those VMAs, I was staying at the Royalton, which at the time was a hotel that everybody wanted to stay in. It's not such a great hotel now. Sorry, Royalton. But they had this like vodka bar, this really small sort of bubble bar that had, you could fit about 20 people in it. And I remember after one of the VMAs, possibly that year or the year after, ending up being in there drinking vodka with Madonna and Goldie and just thinking, this is it. this is my life now. And obviously my life was not normally like that, or I wouldn't need to mention it because it would have been run of the mill. But I remember like thinking, this is it. I'm here with Goldie and Madonna. No one really asked because it was like you could get in if you were sort of, can't remember how I even got in, but obviously it was something to do with the event, so I managed to. But yeah, that was so that sort of MTV early days in the States, and particularly the Fugees, Killing Me Softly.
Drinking vodka with Madonna and Goldie seems like a great way to end the episode. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel
My
podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I have a feeling I could go out for a drink with Kelly and end up talking all night. I just absolutely loved our conversation. Thank you so much again, Kelly, and thank you for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. Remember to like and subscribe on whatever app you're listening to.